Hello, this is Beth Ludwig with Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today I'm reading to you from the Good Housekeeping November issue. We're going to start out with the health series. There's several articles on health in this month's November issue of Good Housekeeping. The first one is called Count Blessings, Not Sheep. If you're a poor sleeper, you probably are grateful for any night with 7 or 8 hours of uninterrupted rest. But maybe you should consider what else you're thankful for. It turns out that enhanced gratitude in all aspects of life may be a way to improve your sleep. When researchers at the University of Manchester, England, had 401 adults fill out questionnaires that rated their gratitude, they found those who scored highest slept longer and better than less appreciative participants. It has to do with your bedtime mindset, said researchers. The grateful people had more positive and fewer sleep-delaying negative thoughts between turning in and drifting off. So take a few moments each day, not just at Thanksgiving, to mentally savor things, large or small, you're thankful for. Sleeping soundly may soon be one of them. Chest pain, 911. When you're having a heart attack, aspirin and nitroglycerin can reduce the clotting and relax blood vessels, which is why experts say that getting these drugs sooner rather than later is important. But when researchers at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine looked at 683 cases of rescue squad calls due to chest pain, only 24% of women received aspirins from paramedics, compared with 32% of men. Similarly, 26% of women were given nitroglycerin versus 33% of men. All statistically significant differences. Even scarier among women who were actually found to be having a heart attack once they got to the ER, none had received aspirin from EMS staff. One possible explanation for this disparity? Women's chest pains may present in uncommon ways. Right-sided pain that shoots to the back rather to the arm or the jaw. That can be attributed to indigestion or other conditions. So says lead study author Zachary Meisel, MD, take the initiative. If you have chest pain, chew one adult or two baby aspirins and call 911. And if you think the responders aren't taking the heart possibility seriously, a simple comment like, could this be a heart attack, might turn on a light bulb. More in the health news. Brain food. You could cut your risk of Alzheimer's disease by a whopping 42%. No, that's not the overblown claim of an anti-aging product, but the gains Columbia University researchers found when they analyzed the diets of 2,100 adults over the age of 65. Those who meals plan included the highest intake of produce, especially leafy greens, tomatoes, and cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and cauliflower, plus fish, nuts, and vinaigrette-type salad dressings, with only small amounts of full fat dairy products, cut their odds of Alzheimer's by that amount. Even people whose diets were in the middle, not the worst, but a little less healthy, lowered their odds by 23%. Give it a rest. Here's more evidence that shut-eye may help you stay thin. In an 11-day study at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, volunteers who were sleep-deprived gained 2.9 pounds on average compared with a well-rested group who didn't put on any weight. The details? After 2 nights of 10-hour rest, the sleep-deprived group only got 4 hours for the next 5 nights, then played catch-up for the remainder. The snoozers rested for 10 hours each evening. Why the huge gain? Sleep loss may affect your metabolism, study authors say, or simply leave you more time to raid the fridge. Their advice? When you've had too little sleep, pay extra attention to how much you're eating. Comfort foods are especially tempting. Or better, aim for at least 7 hours of rest at night. Fill in with naps if you must. Now in this month's issue, there's an interview with Kate Gosling of John and Kate Plus 8 TV show. The article is titled, My Faith and My Kids Are What Matter. Exactly 1 year ago, John and Kate Gosling, stars of TLC's John and Kate Plus 8, appeared with their 8 children on the cover of Good Housekeeping. The couple shared the secret of staying close as they struggled to meet the demands of raising twins, Maddie and Kara, now 9, and sextuplets Alexis, Hannah, Aiden, Colin, Leah, and Joel, now 5. Allowing cameras to catch their unscripted bickering along with the tender moments endeared them to millions of viewers over the show's first 4 seasons. Kate said at the time, "People see us arguing and they will say, 'When will Kate and John split up?' Well, never. He's the one who's been by my side through all of this." But by their 10th wedding anniversary last June, after months of tabloid reports about marital trouble, the Goslings have filed divorce papers. Kate's only public explanation for the split: our goals are different. Kate knows her priorities. She's laser-focused on making the best life for her kids and making sure she stays strong for them as the curveballs keep coming her way. She's also turbocharging her career, which seems only to be on the rise since the split. Beyond planning the show's episodes and her speaking engagements, she's even guest-hosted The View. During this tremendous time of transition, Kate sat down with Good Housekeeping for a frank talk about her new life. Question: Kate, you seem to be doing amazingly well under this pressure. She says, "I'm just doing what I have to do. I've learned to deal with stress. In fact, things that would make the next person go over a cliff don't even make my radar anymore." Well, would they make the old Kate go over a cliff? You seem to go more with the flow these days. Kate, laughing, "Oh, the old Kate would have been long over the cliffs, so it's a good thing that I've put things in perspective. I realize that life isn't perfect. It can't be perfect. I can drive myself nuts trying to make it perfect, or I can just have a lot of fun with the kids. Since I tend to dramatize things, I have taught myself to take a deep breath and ask, is it really as bad as it seems? I realize that if I handle the issues that come my way the way I used to handle them, I would probably have a heart attack. I don't really freak out about everything anymore. I can't afford to. I shock myself a lot with how I do handle things. I'm focusing on my kids. I cannot fail them." Question: how does the attitude translate in terms of your relationship with John? Kate's response: our relationship is getting there. I had a peaceful conversation with him yesterday. That doesn't happen all the time, but my goal is peace. Honestly, when I speak to him on the phone or see him in person, or if I'm able to just picture the old John, I'm all right. I'm just leaving aside the hurt and the pain and the yuckiness of it, because I don't want to argue, I don't want war, I don't want it for the kids, and I don't want the exhaustion of it. I just want solutions and resolutions, and so I have to conduct myself in a certain manner. Question: a year ago, you sat down with Good Housekeeping and said that since your marriage has survived the tough early years with multiples, you felt that you could get through anything. What has this situation taught you about that idea? Kate's answer: just when you think life is tough, it can get a lot tougher. Interviewer, as your marriage ended, was your faith shaken? Kate, I'm still breathing because I have faith. My faith and my kids are the two things that matter. I'm going through this with my kids right now. They kind of feel shaken, and Jesus loves you no matter what comes up a lot. Kara started asking me every night, did you turn the alarm on? I tell her, yes, I did. She's feeling a bit vulnerable, so we have discussions about how it doesn't matter if it's on or not. Jesus is watching you, He's with you, and that comforts me. Question, can you reply to those who say you should have quit TV and handled things privately? Kate, all they need to do is walk a mile in my shoes, and they understand. The show is not a regret. With a reality show, the bottom line is, there's no plot, there's no finale. Question, how did you tell the kids about the divorce, and how are they handling it? Kate, we just discussed the situation with the kids as it would affect them day to day. It wasn't surprising to them, because over the past year I had been traveling a lot, so frequently it was just one parent at home. I remember when we decided to separate that I felt grateful for that year, because it prepared us for this. The kids are okay. They go through their, I miss Daddy, and why can't both of you be here? I try to point them in the positive direction. Remember how we did July 4th together? I hope to do more holidays together. And they go, yay, yay. Question. Let's ask you this. Is there any silver lining to this experience? It seems if you were more playful in the moment. Is that a new thing for you? Kate. Yes, I'm trying to be more in the moment and to challenge myself, too. The boys pushed a screen out of the window a while ago, and I remember getting extra mad because it was dangerous, and also, how in the heck do you put a screen back? And it took me 20 minutes. The film crew was there filming, and I'm thinking, great, but I did it. I figured it out. I figured how to maneuver the screen in, and it was like, yay, I did that. Question. And what's the hardest part of divorce? Kate, it's hardest when it's not my custody days and I'm not with them. I want to be with them. I love them. I don't feel like I have enough time with them normally, let alone now having to split the time. When I'm home, I'll be on the phone or doing paperwork and they'll come hug me. Alexis, the famous house wanderer, will come by and say, oh, I just want a kiss. It's awesome. And making decisions is hard. Not having anyone to bounce ideas off of, and, darn, after getting those kids to bed, there's me, rattling around the house. It's lonely. Question, what gets you through the hard moments and those mornings when you really don't want to get out of bed? Kate, my kids need breakfast. I have to get up because they matter. And what good would it be if I wallowed in self-pity? Sometimes I'm like, okay, I know I've said it before, but now I've really done it this time. And saying that somehow makes me feel better, and I have a choice to give up. It's been a very unpredictable and shocking year, which is why it's a little scary to open my eyes some mornings. I am aware I could fall apart. It's been the hardest thing I've ever done, just to keep going, putting one foot in front of the other. When I run, I just watch my feet go and think, one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. That's how I feel. Eventually, I will get through all this. Question, do you feel like you have a good support system in place? Kate, I'm blown away by the support I've gotten from fans, from people I knew just a bit who turned out to be going through the same thing, from the kids' school. Before school started, I went to a pool party for the third grade. I was really apprehensive about showing up. You know, here I am, the single mom. I didn't know how the other parents would receive me. They went out of their way to let me know that they are there for me, offering to pick up the kids, take them home from school. And my best friend, Jamie, she's getting divorced too, but it's further along than mine, reminds me that I will get through this. We have such a small circle of friends. We've lost so many because they got tired of the scrutiny of being in the public eye, that I'm so grateful when someone will be there, just to be a sounding board. It's something Maddie and Kara are struggling with now, the true friend issue. I just tell them, always be kind, and if they are your friends, they will stick with you through anything, and if not, they wouldn't anyway. Same lessons applies for kids as adults. Question, do you still hope for a lasting marriage? Kate, I know I'm not getting married again. Wait, I don't want to say never because then you're going to play that back at me sometime. Question, how about advice for other moms going through a divorce? Kate's answer, keeping your eye on the goal. For me, the goal is to produce 8 individuals who will actively contribute to society in a positive way. I want them to be as happy in their careers as I am in mine. It might come with a struggle, but if I could have 8 of 8 who are doing something wonderful in their own eyes, contributing to society in a positive manner, that would be success. Maddie says, I'm going to be the first woman president, and I say, go for it. Then she says, I'm going to make paparazzi illegal. Can I do that? I say, sure you can. And then she asks, will you vote for me? And I say, absolutely. Anyone I gave birth to, I'm voting for. Giving advice so your kids will take it. Offering wisdom to your teen or tween can put you on shaky ground. Here's 3 ways to get your children to listen by Jenny Graves. One recent afternoon, while picking my son up from school, I spotted Will, our sociable 14-year-old, hanging out with his friend Dylan and another boy. Will was leaning on Dylan's shoulder, saying silly things in his ear, apparently oblivious to the fact that his pal was trying to talk to the other kid. Dylan seemed increasingly irritated, but Will wasn't getting it. Wasn't getting the message or ignoring the message. I cringed. Was that annoying boy really my sweet kid? And vowed to talk to him about it. But later, when Will and I were alone in the car, I hesitated. The last time I tried to offer him advice on interacting with his peers, he had blown a fuse and accused me of being overly critical. How could I broach the subject so he'd get the message? Or should I just stay out of it and let him learn the subtleties of social interaction on his own? Giving advice is never easy, but when the recipient is a child of a certain age, basically anywhere from 9 to 17, it can be downright treacherous. These are the same kids, after all, who don't want to be seen within 10 feet of you in public, or who roll their eyes every time you open your mouth in front of their friends. Independence is the be-all and end-all of adolescents' existence, so you can imagine how much they hate getting advice from their parents, says Laura Steinberg, author of The 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. If you've been on the receiving end of impatient sighs, sneers, tears, and door slamming, you're not alone. That just goes with the territory. But while there may be no group less receptive to parental input, there's no age when kids are more in need of it. Adolescents face new challenges almost every day. They're learning to make decisions about everything from how to manage their time to which clique to hang out with, and they need parents' guidance, says Steinberg. So how do you break through their resistance and give them advice they'll actually hear? Consider these strategies from the experts. Silence your inner critic. Case history. When Deanne Scott Edwards' 15-year-old son, Brady, was looking for his first summer job last spring, she heard him on the telephone talking in a monotone. He said, I'm wondering if you have any jobs at your pool. The Des Moines, Iowa mom recalls. I was appalled. He sounded so listless. But I knew better than to criticize him, so I said calmly, Hey, Brady, it's great that you're taking the initiative to try to get a job, but it's a good idea to think about what you sound like from an employer's perspective. You might want to write down what you want to say and practice it a bit before you call again. His response, I know how to do this, Mom. Edwards was doubtful, but Brady's next telephone call came as a pleasant surprise. He introduced himself, his voice had energy, and was much more personable, she recalls. He had apparently internalized what I said, even though I thought he ignored my advice. Much as you may be tempted to put on your mom hat and offer up a critique of what your teen is doing wrong, hold your tongue. The most effective way to get your point across is to keep your comments clear, concise, and positive, says Adele Faber, co-author of How to Talk to Teens So They Will Listen. Teenagers tune out long lectures, and they often react to criticism by defending their behavior. So briefly, non-judgmental comments, especially ones that emphasize the positive action that's desired, have the best chance of making an impact. For instance, instead of saying, "You're so mean to your sister, you're always picking on her," Faber suggests spinning that sentiment into a comment like, "Is there something you want your sister to know that you think would help her? Please make sure that you tell her in a way that won't hurt her feelings." Here's another case history. Michelle Howe's son, Jamie, a high school senior who excels at pole vaulting, Howe was counting on his skills to earn him a college scholarship. There's just one problem. He was not working hard enough to improve his skills, she said. His coach had been telling him that what he needed to do to improve, but Jamie basically ignored him. Howe was dying to get her 2 cents in, especially when she saw him struggling at meet after meet. But she got nowhere if she just blurted out what she thought he should do. Finally, one day Jamie said, "I can't believe I'm doing worse this year than last year," she recalls. "I knew that was my opening. So I said casually, 'Do you have any idea why this is happening?'" He sheepishly said he should probably start running the hurdles like his coach had suggested. "I said, 'That sounds like a good idea. Why don't you try it and see if it helps?'" The next week he changed his training routine, and voila, his pole vaulting improved. The lesson to be learned, of course, is you want to simply tell your child what to do to improve a bumpy situation. But with adolescents, you need to back off and give them some leeway to solve their own problems. And asking questions rather than dictating solutions is an effective way. Questions encourage kids to think for themselves, and asking rather than telling gives them the sense that you trust them, which reduces their combativeness, says Faber. The most effective questions are ones that let your child be or feel like an expert. For instance, if your disorganized daughter is frustrated that she can't find a homework assignment, you could say, "What systems are you using to organize your work?" Maybe she'll share her system and you can offer a tweak it. If she admits that she doesn't have a system, you could ask if she wants your help. Solicited feedback is usually better than unsolicited. Or try the let's collaborate approach. Explain your concern, then solicit your kid's suggestions for how to solve it. For instance, if you think your adolescent is staying up too late, you could say, "I've noticed you're having trouble getting up in the morning, and I wonder if you need more sleep. What do you think would help you feel more rested?" The two of you can write down strategies and decide which ones to try. If she thinks it would help to sleep 15 more minutes in the morning, let her try it for a week or two, even if you think it's a bad idea. It's hard for parents to sit back and watch their kids make mistakes, but sometimes that's what you need to do to let them learn. Once she's had the chance to try it her way and see that it doesn't work, she may be more open to your suggestions. Try to catch them when they're feeling chatty. Here's a case history. Mary Beth Sammons, a mother of three, has been concerned for some time about her 16-year-old daughter Emily's on-again, off-again boyfriend. "This boy kept going back and forth between Emily and this other girl," says Sammons. "Then he asked the other girl to the prom, and Emily was really upset. I felt it was like demeaning to her to keep waiting around for him, but I knew that if I said that, she would just get mad. So Sammons waited until she and Emily were sharing downtime with Emily showing her how to text message. We were talking in a relaxed way, so I said, 'When is prom again? How's that whole thing going?' Emily said she was still upset, so Sammons took the opportunity to offer advice. I said, 'I understand how hurt you are, but think of it this way. If two boys liked you, do you think it would be fair to lead both along?' Emily thought for a moment and acknowledged that her boyfriend's behavior wasn't very respectful. So Salmon said, "I agree, and I think you deserve better than that." She recalls, "Emily's not over him yet, but there's been a step in the right direction." A formal, "come on here, we need to talk" approach usually isn't the best way to get through to a teen. But if you weave advice into everyday conversation, you're less likely to encounter hostility. Pay attention to when your kids open up naturally. For some, it's after school. For others, it's before bed, when they're able to reflect on their day. Those are good times to talk because you're both calmer, so kids are less likely to feel they're under a microscope. If the issue at hand is a real hot button, allow both of you to cool off before discussing it. Kids are hypersensitive to your emotions. They're much more receptive when you're relaxed. In a low-key moment, you can say, "I was thinking about what happened." Conversations tend to go better when they're less emotionally charged. Derek Howard, father of two teens, says waiting is his secret weapon when it comes to giving advice that his kids can really use. "Recently, my older daughter put us off a school project until the last minute. 2 days later, we were in the car, and I said, 'It looked like you got yourself in a jam time-wise with that project.' She admitted that she procrastinated too long, so I said, 'Next time you have a big project, it would help to remember this experience and how hard it was to do it at the last minute.' We were both a lot calmer discussing it because I'd let some time pass, and the advice really seemed to sink in. I decided to bring up Will's social mistake while he and I were eating at his favorite burger joint and chit-chatting about the day's events. He was telling me about a misunderstanding between two of his friends at school that morning. So I said, 'That reminds me. When I picked you up from school the other day, I noticed you were trying to distract Dylan when he was talking to Nick. Do you think he's okay with that?' Will looked instantly suspicious and said, 'You know, he does the same thing to me, Mom.' 'Does it bother you?' I asked, trying not to jump in with advice. Will was quiet for a moment. Then he said, 'It's a little annoying. I don't like it when people hang on me.' 'I don't either,' I said. 'I don't think most people do.' Then I changed the subject. 'Did he say, 'Thanks, Mom, I'm going to remember that?' 'Of course not. But something makes me believe he got the message. Even if teens don't respond, or they respond poorly to your input, they might well be listening. When you give advice the right way, they tend to see it for what it really is, an expression of a parent's love." Now for the Ask Peggy column. Question: "My coworker got laid off, and now all she wants to do is trash talk our company. I still love my job. How do I support her without joining the bashing?" Peggy's answer: "Your friend's negativity is a natural reaction to stress. Listen to her concerns. You don't have to agree or disagree. Steer the conversation towards her job search and provide contacts if you can. Every few weeks, check in to offer encouragement. Plan get-togethers that are more fun, maybe a manicure or a movie, but not a gripe session over coffee." Second question. Well, that's all we have time for today. This has been Beth Ludwig with Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I have been reading from the November issue of the Good Housekeeping magazine.